Hello, Doug.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay, my man?
I can hear you great.
Awesome.
Can you hear my wife?
I can. I talked to her earlier.
Oh. She just yelled something in the background.
I heard that. Also, that's Karina.
That's right. Good work. Great pronunciation.
Yeah.
Great pronunciation.
She answered the phone earlier and corrected me. And I know she's done a little bit of lyrical work for Built to Spill. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's awesome.
She does all kinds of stuff, though. She does all kinds of businessy type stuff, which she hates, but she does a great job. And just because we don't want to get a manager. And then she also, you know, like, I don't do much without running it by her. Musically and stuff too. She knows what we're supposed to be doing, and so I check with her often about everything.
Quality control, huh?
Absolutely.
I watched this. Okay, so first of all, congratulations on your new rhythm section.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit, but I saw a clip, and the interviewer was asking you about. You played and it said Built to Spill is still a band, as if there was any doubt. I never doubted it, but it was because of some biography or some bio that was written for you guys, and you said it was kind of dramatic, and I think you said your wife wrote it. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, she wrote our bio for our last record, and, you know, I think every record we make, there gets to a point. Well, maybe not when I was young, when I was in my 20s and teens and stuff. Then I was just psyched to do everything. But as I got older, it sort of, as I work on a record, I lose sight of what I ever liked about any of it in the first place.
Right, right.
And,
right.
And you know, it just gets really frustrating, and I get really down on myself, and so I think that's kind of what she was addressing in that.
Because I didn't actually read it, but
yeah, it's kind of just at one point it just talks about how hard it is for me to do it. it's kind of silly.
Okay.
I mean, and then anyway, that bio kind of followed us around for a while because that's just the way it works. You know, you got to write a new bio. So when we went to South by Southwest last year, maybe, I wrote that other bio, which was just the one sentence, just to, because I didn't think anyone needed to know anything else.
Now, you got a brand new rhythm section. That's really exciting. I've seen Built to Spill, I'm guessing, between 15 and 20 times. And
wow.
It's the same, it was the same rhythm section every time. And that was, is it Brett Netson and Scott Plouffe? Is that right?
Nope, Nelson. Netson's the guitar guy.
Okay, I will forever get those screwed up. I think even on the internet when I was looking it up, they were screwing it up too.
Of course, totally. Hell, if you've seen us five times, you're forgiven, that sort of a thing. But you've seen us 20 times, a fucking letter doesn't matter.
Probably something like that, yeah. So what's different about the new rhythm section, man? Is there a big difference?
Every person that plays every instrument has their own way of doing it. So of course, you know, it's different. They're really good. I think what's great about them is that they have learned all the old material and they play it real true to what it was. You know, they're not trying to make it their own.
Right.
But then the new stuff we're working on. They are making their own, but they're also, you know, they know what Built to Spill is kind of about. You know, they've Jason, the bass player, has been our roadie for 10 years or more, and Steve's been part kind of hanging around our crew for a few years too. So they really get what we're up to. And that's the main difference, just that they're different people, but you know,
right.
Really, it seems like an almost unbelievably smooth transition to me.
Because that can be rough, man. It seems like if they've been around your crew for a long time, and they've been and they've learned your material true, that seems like it would make it much easier.
Totally. I mean, I know them. They're great friends, and they also are great musicians. And they just jumped into the band. Like, I don't even think I asked them to join the band. I think they just kind of knew that's what was happening. They're both multi-instrumentalists, so it was just kind of like I had to decide who was going to play bass and who was going to play drums, and that was it. And it was didn't have to talk to anyone or try anyone out or experience anything that might have been really, you know, awkward and annoying about replacing guys, you know.
Now the replacing part, was that a little tough to deal with? Was that your idea? Was that their idea? How did that all work out?
Those guys quit. Those guys, we went on a tour last September for a month, and then about two or three shows before the end of the tour, Brett sat me down and told me that he was burnt out and didn't want to do it anymore.
Right.
And that he had... And then, like, a little while later that day, Scotty told me the same thing. And they both had kind of known it for a while, maybe even the whole tour, or most of the tour, and just kind of kept it to themselves until the last couple of days and let me know so that I would, you know, know what was happening. So it was all mellow and respectful, and they just both had kind of had enough of it.
Now, is this something they had talked about amongst themselves, or it was just a random thing?
Yeah, they had talked about it. Somehow they had talked about it. And I didn't find out any of the details and stuff. I don't really know exactly how it all went down with them and stuff. But I was, I was bummed, of course.
Of course.
But I also understand, you know. I understand it's not for everyone, and I understand putting in that much time of doing it. You know, it's a lot of time. I think Scotty especially, he's not a... You know, Scott never was... I don't think he ever really wanted to play in a band or anything. He kind of ended up in one.
Yeah.
And then he liked it and did it for a while, and now he's moved on to baking, which he thought he was going to do in the first place. So. And then Brett's also kind of... He's got his own thing going on. I think he's doing this electronic music. This makes more sense to him. I think it's more... fulfilling, you know. I don't know. I think as the band got more guitar players in it, Brett felt like he kind of was disappearing because anything that he wanted to do that was his sort of wild bass style wouldn't really work anymore. Started to get lost, in all the guitars. And he did it and he embraced it and did it right and understood what was necessary. But, you know, that might have been something to him, too, where he just felt like it wasn't creatively satisfying so much anymore, because he was more of a, you know, he liked to play chords and lead bass. He doesn't like to just play whatever, root notes over and over again. He finds that boring.
Interesting. So yeah, I mean, between you, Jim Roth, and Brett Netson, a hell of a guitar mm-hmm. army, and yeah, the bass player probably just has to hold it down in all situations at that point.
Exactly. And you listen to, like, There's Nothing Wrong with Love, and he's just, like, going all over the place.
Yes.
And that's Brett Nelson bass playing. And then, and somewhat on the next records, but I think maybe like Keep It Like a Secret was the record where it was like, oh, I can't hear all these cool chords I'm doing. You know, you put 10 guitars on this song. So, I think that's kind of a little bit of it. And they all, you know, they have wives, and Brett has all these kids and stuff.
How many kids does he have, man?
I don't know, like... 30 or something.
Jeez, spread all over?
No, he actually has three kids from three different marriages to one woman.
Really? That's interesting. Really. I want to, you know, it's funny you touched upon Nothing Wrong with Love and the more simplicity of the guitar playing compared to, and the more extrafluous, whatever, bass playing, and superfluous, rather. And I was curious, I was listening to a song like Car last night, and some stuff off Nothing Wrong with Love. And did you always have in your head that you wanted a huge, huge guitar sound? Because that's very sparse guitar in that early stuff. Just kind of strummy, non-affected electric guitar work. And was that always in your mind? Did you always want a bigger and bolder sound like you do now, like you have been for a long time? Or did that just kind of come to you over time? Did you initially set out to have it more simple?
Well, that came over time. I think initially I didn't even think about those things. I think when I first started making music, and even up until that point, you know, into my mid-20s, I think that I just... I don't even think I understood tone, you know, guitar tone or, you know, like that record. Another thing about There's Nothing Wrong With Love, I don't think there's any reverb on the whole record.
Right.
You know, it's just like totally dry. It's basically like a four-track recording, you know, which is kind of what I was doing in those days. It was just a studio version of a four-track where everything's just dry, simple. I didn't even think about that stuff. It's almost like a, it's almost like a mock-up of a record, you know, like this is kind of how we want the things to go.
Like a demo almost.
Yeah, totally. Like nothing's really taken, even less than a demo, because I think a demo, you're kind of trying to get the tone. It's almost like a mock-up of just like, well, these will be the parts, and then we'll figure out what they actually should sound like later.
Really? And then you put that out. That's amazing.
Well, I didn't even think about that stuff. I mean, it sounded cool to me, but I didn't really know what I was doing at all, you know? I didn't really, and I still don't. I don't mean to say that I have figured anything out, but at some point, tone and stuff became more important to me. I think growing up, I was into, you know, punk rock and roll and stuff, and it all kind of sounded a certain way, and I didn't even know how to make it sound that way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
And then over time, I got into soul music and reggae, and I started to, like, get, oh, different music has whole different tones, and there's whole different feels going on, and then at that point, you know, then I started messing around more with my amps and stuff and, you know, learning a little bit about what sounds good and finding an amp that worked for me. I mean, I'd been trying that all along, and that might be part of the problem with There's Nothing Wrong With Love. I just didn't have a good amplifier.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it, man. There's nothing wrong with that record, I'll tell you that. I find that probably the limitations in production that you experienced maybe made you actually write better song. I'm not saying like the songs have to be damn good to stick out when there's nothing on them, you know what I mean? And the songs completely stand up on that record.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I definitely am way more into you know, the tone of songs, you know. There's just so many things going on in music. It's kind of like you focus on this thing or that thing, and you can't really focus on everything. I mean, maybe some people are just so natural at music that they handle everything at once just because they get it, you know, but not me.
Well, you know, I think people assume other people are natural like that, but I would assume you are, so maybe nobody is, you know? If you aren't, then I don't know if anybody is, you know? So when you started getting into wider tones, now the first Built to Spill song I ever heard, I actually remember where I was. It was in 1990, let's see, probably 97, and my buddy Aaron gave me a headphones and put on I Would Hurt a Fly. And that song in particular, man, it has the most amazing intro. It's so smooth, so kind of psychedelic. Do you find that that particular record was a breakthrough with tone as far as what you're talking about?
Definitely. I mean, that's the next record, right? That was the record after There's Nothing Wrong With Love.
Oh, is that, is that the right next one? Okay.
Yeah, and so, yeah, this time we were kind of, we definitely were all about tone on that record. But, you know, that might be the big turning point. I think what it was is, now that I think about it, is Beatles. I got super into Beatles, and of course I knew Beatles and listened to them somewhat, but right when we started to make that record was when I started just listening to just all that, you know, White Album and Abbey Road, just all the really amazing sounding Beatles stuff. And we worked our asses off trying to get tones on that record to match things like that, and we wasted so much time just trying to get tones that were just really impossible for us. We didn't know what we were doing. That's when that stuff became important, I think.
Yeah, you say the Beatles, man. I just saw Paul McCartney a couple weeks ago here. And,
is that right?
Oh my God, it's still mind blowing. All that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I saw him on TV a while ago too, and I couldn't believe how killer he sings still.
He invited Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl and Pat Smear out for Helter Skelter, the second half of Abbey Road, the medley, and Long Tall Sally or something like that. And it was really amazing, man.
That's cool. That's neat.
Let's see here. Now, every time I mention Built to Spill to people that are been around a little longer than I have, they talk about a band called Tree People. I don't know much about Tree People, but I know it was before Built to Spill. And before that, there was some band called Farm Days. Was that a high school band or something?
Exactly. Farm Days was There's Nothing Wrong with Love's lineup.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Ian Brett Nelson and Andy Capps.
Okay. And so was Tree People, was that supposed to be something completely different than Built to Spill, or did you just get new members and change the name? How did you go from Tree People to Built to Spill?
Well, when I was a teenager in Boise, there was a great punk rock band called State of Confusion, hardcore band that I'd always go see. And I kind of became friends with them. They were a little older than me, but their girlfriends were in high school, and I was friends with them. So I got to kind of meet them and hang out and became friends with them. And I'd go watch them practice and stuff. I was just super into them.
Yeah.
And then about the time I finished high school, their drummer took off and kind of switched around. I ended up playing a little bit of bass for them, and then we decided to start Tree People, and everyone kind of switched instruments, and we were here in Boise and decided, the drummer decided he wanted to move to Boise or to Seattle, and we were all like, yeah, that sounds good, and we all moved to Seattle, and it was a serious band. It was all we did. We had shitty jobs, and then we made sure to get together and practice 3 or 4 times a week and, you know, book shows and make records, and that was really all we worked on. We were a really pretty tight-knit group of people, too. A couple of the guys were brothers, and then one of the guys was one of the brothers' best friends from junior high, and then I got myself into the group, and we were all, you know, it was a pretty serious thing for a few years, and fell apart in a couple of weird ways, and then I started Built to Spill. And Built to Spill started, that first record was going to be Tree People songs. So it was kind of a little different direction for Tree People, and certainly if Tree People had recorded the record, it would have been vastly different. But Tree People was kind of a punk band. Post-punk is what we called it back then.
Okay.
It was like, what it meant to me was like, something like Husker Du or Dinosaur. It meant punk rock and like classic rock and pop and those things kind of coming together. It was, you know, not just a pure reaction like punk rock kind of was. It was a reaction, but also tempered with a little bit of appreciation for pop and guitar solos and that kind of shit.
I was watching a Tree People video last night, and I believe you are a trendsetter in a couple different ways. You had the beard back then, man.
Yeah, I had a beard back then.
And I'll tell you what, everybody, well, not right this second, but it became very in vogue much later. Do you feel like you kind of kicked off that movement in any way, or is that just how Boise folks do it?
You know what? I was always trying to get the bald look going, but people don't seem as interested in following that one.
Oh, wow. I can see that, yeah. I know a couple people, though. They're rocking it well, just like you do.
Because of me?
Perhaps, man, or at least I guess more shamelessly because of you, you know.
they might have gotten hair implants if not for me.
If it hadn't been for you, yeah. Hey, man,
I
heard.
Feel good about that.
I heard that Tree People did a set with Nirvana. Is that accurate?
No, I mean we played a show that they played, but no, never played with them. And something happened too.
What do you mean you did a show? Like, you were on the same bill?
Like, we played on the same bill, exactly.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
And then I left the band at one point. Those guys did maybe a tour or two across the country without me. And I think with just one original member. Yeah, with one original member, Scotty. But they somehow met Nirvana somewhere. Like, it was... you know, there was an interview with Kurt Cobain, Rolling Stone, where he like mentions hanging out with those guys. But
I don't think
anything happened other than we shared a stage, but not at the same time, and they met those guys.
Oh, okay. Yeah, cause on Nothing Wrong with Love, I believe a long time ago, I was reading through the liner notes and all the thank yous, and at the very end it said for Kurt, and I was wondering if that was Kurt Cobain or not. I always was curious about that. Is that who it was to?
It was, and I wasn't really a Nirvana fan.
Yeah.
But the reason why this record happened, to keep it in some sort of context, this record came out when nobody knew anything about Built to Spill. This record came out at a time when I was, like, ready to sell my whole future just to get enough money to buy a little bit of cheap recording equipment to make records at home. So that was my whole dream at that point in my life, was just to be able to get enough gear to record at home. And that was as far as I ever thought this thing would go, if it would go that far. So basically that is just like, thanks for the money, because Up Records was financed through Sub Pop, and Sub Pop was able to pick up something like Up because of Nirvana. So that's what that meant. That was a financial thank you.
Okay,
I looked through that thank you list recently because my friend James had written the chorus, Dystopian Dream Girl.
Yeah.
Came down to Your Life or Mine, all that stuff. And I was like, God, I wonder if I ever, did I even credit him for that? And so I looked at the record, and sure enough, I credited him for it. And I decided to read the thank you list. And it was like, I couldn't even remember half the people on it. There's a couple people on it that I just can't believe they were being thanked on that. It was like a whole nother world. I mean, I don't want to say who those people were because, you know, but it was quite a funny, eye-opening experience.
Wow, that is funny, man. Now, speaking of those early Up days, I always hear that Modest Mouse was very influenced by Built to Spill. Then occasionally I'm like, people say, Built to Spill was also in turn influenced by Modest Mouse. I know you guys were on the same label. Do you feel like there was some back and forth between your two bands? I feel like in the mid to late 90s, you would hear both bands mentioned at the same time all the time. What do you think about that? How'd you meet those guys, and were you influential on Modest Mouse, a young Modest Mouse?
Well, we were on Up Records. Chris Tacchino, the guy who ran the label, I think this might have been just like a year into Up or something, and he would always send me stuff that he was, you know, into and thinking about signing. So he sent me Modest Mouse demos, and I just totally loved it. It was like my favorite thing right away, and everyone I played it for would love it. I mean, Isaac's voice was so incredible, and you know, everyone was great. The band was so good, it was so fresh sounding. And Chris, when he told me about him on the phone, I was like, what are they like? He's like, oh, they kind of sound like Built to Spill. And he would never, like, Chris would never even do that kind of thing. Like, he would never say something like that.
Right.
So it was kind of a joke. And so immediately I was like, oh, that doesn't sound good. Because I'd heard things that people had said sound like Built to Spill, and they bummed me out. And when I heard it, I was just like, I don't think this sounds like Built to Spill. This is just so great. So yeah, I was a huge fan of it, and it definitely was a big influence, and it still is. That stuff is still a big influence. I think just Isaac's singing is so incredible and really inspiring to me. It's kind of, I don't know. I think it's like Bob Dylan and Frank Black, you know. I think those were big influences for Isaac and me. And I know that those guys knew about us when they were kids and stuff. So,
yeah.
But my feeling about that is that they, that's just coincidental type of stuff. If they'd grown up in somewhere else, you know, it would have been something else. And I think that they would have made pretty much the same music regardless of whether or not we existed.
It seems like Isaac just has a really unorthodox approach and is just super prolific. I agree. I'm amazed by how much he can hang in there and keep going and going and going. It's pretty amazing.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Are you a vegetarian, Doug?
Mostly. I've been eating fish here and there for the last couple of years, but yeah, mostly.
How do you approach lyrics on a slightly different note? Occasionally, man, there's certain lyrics that stick out in my head of yours, and in particular, I was thinking of one. Let's see, what the hell is it? Best not talk too loud. You're not as smart as you require of them. It's off mm-hmm. of and just lines like that make so much sense. Do you remember certain like lightning bolt moments when you came up with these lyrics? Like, and those seem the ones that stick with people. Do you know what I mean? Like very inspired uh-huh. things. Yeah.
Not so much. I mean, maybe every once in a while, I'm like, oh, that's really good. You know, that's great. Okay. But it's so rare and it's so hard. I'm doing it right now. I'm writing lyrics for songs, and it's just not my forte at all. And, you know, like I said, Karen helps sometimes. That line that you said, I don't remember. What I remember most about that line, whenever I hear it, whenever I think about it, is how awkward it is and how I was trying to, you know, I think you know what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
But I said it so awkwardly, it kind of annoys me. But then sometimes when I say something awkwardly in a song, I like it. It's like, oh, that's cool. That's the only way it would fit in the song, you know, and that makes, that kind of appeals to me. I find sometimes, like this thing I'm working on right now, my favorite lines in the song are like cliche things that don't really, you know, like my favorite line is round and round and round we go, which probably has been used in 100 songs. It's stupid, but for some reason I love it, you know.
So are you saying you just wrote that lyric recently?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. You know what's funny? Round and Round is a song title that's, maybe you should call your song Round and Round, because there's Ariel Pink, there's this guy named like Tevin Campbell, there's Rat, there's like half a exactly. dozen Round and Round songs. It's funny.
Another Round and Round song. So anyway, the way that things appeal, the way that you decide to do stuff is so arbitrary. Just something resonates with you for whatever reason. And that's how it is the whole process, you know, lyrics especially, but all the music and stuff, it's kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't, you know, I don't have a vision. I kind of chip away until something looks good or sounds good or whatever.
Yeah. Also the line, I want to see the movies of my dreams. Everybody loves it, sings along to it, but brilliant line. I love that song, Car, by the way.
Thank you. Well, that line I agree is a good one, and I don't know how I got it, where I stumbled across it. People say I got it from a movie. Maybe I did. I don't know.
And the saltness.
It's not horribly original, but it's something that resonates. And I say it four times in a row. Maybe that helps it stick in people's heads.
And the solo you do on that song is incredible, man. Do you remember how you came up with that particular solo? It's brilliant, dude.
No, thanks. I don't know that I like it all that much, but I appreciate that.
What don't you like about it?
I don't know. I can't even think of it right now. I remember maybe I don't like the effect on it very much. It's a little too, it's got some sort of flangey thing on it that just doesn't seem to fit into the song. You know, that's me with my tonal hindsight. You know, at the time I was like, well, that sounds cool, yeah. But now I listen to it, it's like, that doesn't fit with it all. That's like clumsy and too heavy sounding on top of this other stuff. But, you know, that's what music's all about. Sometimes, you know, who knows what is going to do it for who.
Yeah, I agree. What's your favorite Built to Spill record, man?
I don't think I have one. I think, I really think that I have a pretty even feeling about almost all of them. There's a couple that I don't care for. I don't care for The Normal Years. I don't care for Live. I don't care much for the Built to Spill Caustic Resin. Those three things I think are mediocre. And then the rest of the stuff, I feel like I did as good as I could do on it.
How do you approach performing, man? I've always admired you for your. It seems like you have a very, very modest approach to performing. You let the music speak for itself. And maybe one of the main differences between you and, say, maybe Modest Mouse, and let's say as a front man, Isaac Brock, very, very demonstrative and expressive in a certain way, maybe physically. Whereas you are fine with letting the music speak for yourself, for itself rather. When you started out, was that something intentional? Does that come from nerves, or does it come from your guitar parts being fairly complicated and you have to hold that down? Do you feel like you're a modest performer, Doug?
Yeah, I think that I just didn't really ever have it in me to jump around and stuff. And sometimes I wish that I did a little bit more of that, and I enjoy, watching a band do it. But, it's got to be real, it's got to be genuine, and if you're not really genuinely that kind of a person, then you don't do it. So, I feel like I get into it. It's funny, our bass player Jason was talking about how he saw a video of himself playing with Built to Spill, and he was like, oh yeah, and he kind of remembered a part, and he's like, oh yeah, this part's coming up. I remember, like, I totally got into it and, did something. He's like kind of waiting for it, and then the moment passes and he's just still standing there playing. So I kind of imagine, and I'm the same way, I imagine, like, I feel like I'm jumping around and shit, but I'm probably just standing there the whole time.
Well, I feel like you're really channeling the music. Or not channeling, but you're summoning it from some place. I mean, because you're clearly completely enveloped in it, Mostly your head bobbing, I think, back and forth.
Yeah, I think that's even something that's sort of new for me, is my head bobbing, because it sort of became, just over time, like, at some point I started stomping my foot, just weird things that kind of made it easier for me to sing, so it sort of get lost in it. When I was younger, I would talk more to the audience and stuff, and I do remember a moment where I was kind of like, I felt like I had a little too much power with the things I was saying, and that I would say something kind of like make a bad joke and people would laugh, and I feel kind of guilty about it. So I sort of just stopped, and now I can't get it back. Now I actually really am shy. It's like, how do you address this many people? Every brain has something else going on, and it's like, I don't want to, I don't know how to talk to these people.
I think maybe you do a little drinking before the show and possibly come out and have the band play without you playing and then dance with them a little bit and then get on the mic and strap it on, and you might, break through that. I don't know.
I want to try it. Who does that? Did someone do that, or is that up for grabs?
I think it's up for grabs. I mean, I'm sure somebody's done it, but it's a really cool way to loosen up, I would imagine, yeah.
Well, thanks, Jesse. I like that.
Yeah. You revisited some of your old Built to Spill songs and redid them. It's called the Electronic Anthology Project, and that might have been a couple years ago, but I actually just heard of it. What was that all about, dude? Did you enjoy it?
That actually is Brett Nelson. That's not me at all.
Oh, that's not you at all. Oh, okay.
But what it is Brett does that. He revisits bands' albums as total cheesy new wave. But he plays it all himself too. If you listen to it, it sounds all sequenced, but everything is being actually played on keyboards. It's kind of amazing. But anyway, so his first project. What he wanted to do was he'd do a new wave cover album of whatever album or artist, and then have the original singer sing the songs, though.
Oh.
So he did it with Built to Spill, because he knew me. And so all I did was sing. I just re-sang the songs. He did everything else. And then he did one with Jay Mascus, and he just did one with Death Cab for Cutie. So that's kind of what he's doing. That's part of why he's not in Built to Spill.
Now, you speak of he was covering these people, Jay Mascus and this and that. Now, I've noticed that you have an amazing range for cover songs, and your band pulls them off incredibly well, and very complicated songs. I'm actually quite impressed. I just saw a version of Don't Fear the Reaper that you guys did in San Jose with the new rhythm section and some dude on cowbell. And, man, you guys really pulled it off. I mean, the sound quality wasn't great because it was just a handheld camera thing. How do you approach your covers? I know that I've seen you personally do, like, George Harrison, What Is Life? And shortly after, that song became one of my favorites. Like, I'm an incredible Beatles fan. I'm a huge Beatles fan, I should say. But I wasn't terribly familiar with that record, and it got me into that. Mm-hmm. And I saw you play that probably in, I don't know, I bet you it was 2002 or something like that.
Sure, uh-huh.
And I saw you cover like Macy Gray, that fucking I Try to Walk Away and I Trip, Try to Walk Away and I Stumble, or whatever.
Sure.
And that really brought me, oh, that is an okay song to like, type thing. How do you approach your covers, man?
Well, when I first heard that Macy Gray song, I like saw it on VH1, and it was like, and I thought it sounded like a Modest Mouse song. Like, that song is great.
Yeah.
And that George Harrison song, that was a hit when I was a kid. That was on the radio all the time when I was a kid. So, but we just sort of, sometimes it's you know, like Macy Gray was pretty casual. I think maybe I kind of played a little bit of it because I'd learned it just to sing for fun. And Scott was like, hey, we should play that, you know, something like that or whatever. I think What Is Life, I was like, we're doing this song. We're taking this on tour. Sometimes we did a Ripple by the Grateful Dead at one point, and that was, like, I was using it to sound check my vocals, just because of pre-song, and then the band would start joining in, and eventually it evolved into being a cover. We've done that a few times, where I just have been sound checking the song, and over a week or two, the band learns it, and we start playing it.
Wow.
And so, and like, the Reaper, that was a song where we actually, the new Built to Spill guys were getting together to learn old songs, and then I just kind of started playing that, and we started goofing around with it, and then we were like, someone started listening to it on the CD and like getting more serious about it, and that was a song where we really thought it was over our heads, that we didn't really have the, you know, we wouldn't be able to figure it out,
the chops.
And we wouldn't be able to play it. Yeah, exactly. But over time, we just kept working at it and working at it, and we'd, like, unlock little secrets to it and how it works. And Steve, our drummer, is amazing. He can kind of figure out anything. Like, you know, Scotty's a great drummer, but he does not tear things apart the way Steve does. So Steve got serious. Oh, no! Are you okay, buddy? A squirrel just fell off my house.
Jesus
He's
Christ.
Fine. I started crashing. I thought something fell, and it was a squirrel. He's jumping trees now. So anyway, Steve could figure out every little nuance of it. And so over a long time, we'd work on the Built to Spill songs, and we'd be like, hey, let's play Reaper. We'd get all excited and play the Reaper and get closer and closer. And sometimes we'd have a session where we'd just, like, sit there and play it super quietly and try to harmonize, you know, work on our harmonies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we spent hours and hours, and so the Reaper was basically our escape from work, and also it was a meaningful thing. When you learn covers, you kind of ruin the song for yourself. You know,
you reveal its secrets. Yeah,
exactly. The Reaper though became more and more amazing as you unpeeled it.
It's a great song, man.
It is. It's such a perfect song.
Do you see some comparisons between Reaper, Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult, and Golden Earring's Twilight Zone by any chance?
No, I don't. But the Reaper and Burning For You, you know that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That other Blue Oyster Cult song, those songs are almost exactly the same song, believe it or not.
Really?
They're like almost the same chord progression. They use a lot of the same sort of, I don't know, same sort of tricks or whatever, they're very, very similar.
You know, Doug, my band got to open for your band one time. We are called, actually, it's completely rebuilt, called Smile Brigade, and it was at...
Oh, yeah.
It was at some outdoor thing.
Yeah, at the school. Yeah, it's at the University of Washington. I totally remember that.
That was a cool show, man. For me,
that
anyway.
Was a cool
for
show.
Me, it was. And I remember I was wondering why you didn't bring any merch that day. I was trying to buy something, and you signed a poster to my buddy. Do you not bring merch sometimes? You just wing it like that?
Yeah, you know what? We kind of do everything ourselves, you know. So we don't have a merchandising company or anything that does that stuff. What we do, when we go out on tour, we definitely take merch. But if we go... That was just like we went to Seattle and played one show and then went home. So when we do that, sometimes we're just not organized enough to have shirts ready to go and shit.
Right, understood. Do you feel like you're a natural born performer? You know, when you were a child, did you a lot of air guitar, a lot of air microphone with the hairbrush or whatever? Is that just a byproduct of the music that you make? Did you always strive to be a performer to get yourself out there?
You know, I think I kind of was as a kid. You know, I definitely liked. You know, I had an older brother and sister, and I loved, you know, being around them and their friends and stuff. And I felt like I always was kind of, you know, goofing around, kind of class clownish a little bit. But I think that when I got older and started doing it, I became a little more shy and a little more self-conscious. And I didn't think of myself as a performer. And I even thought of the idea of a performer, entertainer. That all seemed kind of frivolous to me. But now I completely embrace it, and I think that's actually what I'm best at now is performing. I feel like writing and playing and that stuff, I'm not as good as I am at actually performing. And it has to do with the band, too. I mean, I'm completely connected to the band. I play the solo thing, and I'm not good at that. I played one recently. I play them every once in a while, and I don't feel comfortable at all. But with that band and the songs that we've written over the years and stuff, and, you know, I feel super confident about performing with those people. You know, we went on tour with when we were a young band. We played Europe with the Foo Fighters when they were a brand new band.
Wow.
And it was like not very fun. People didn't like us at all. We also weren't a very good band at that time. It was a temporary lineup in between lineups, kind of, so we didn't have much rehearsal behind us, and we're kind of shitty. And the Foo Fighters fans hated us. And I decided back then, I was like, I don't want to play shows for people that don't want to see us.
Right.
That's just horrible. So we always headline tours, and, you know, we had a few chances to open for bands, and I was like, no, I don't want to do that at all. But then a couple of years ago, after this band's been doing it for so long, and I feel like we're good enough and that we get enough accolades, that we did some shows with the Kings of Leon, and it was like...
Nice.
We played these giant places, and people did not give a fuck about us. We didn't sell anything. And it was really fun. It was great. I didn't care at all. I was totally proud of our band. I thought we were great. People didn't get it. They didn't get it. And I think some people did. So, you know, it's gotten to the point where I just really enjoy the band and like what we're doing so much that, I don't know, I have a confidence in that I've never had in my own music or the band up until recently.
It does seem like Built to Spill is one of those kind of a slow burning band as far as getting into them. Like, I saw you guys the first time, it was at Bumbershoot, and I believe it was on the same day as like Sonic Youth and Sleater-Kinney were playing. It was probably 1997 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And, I thought it was great, but I didn't know any of the songs. None of it stuck. But then once I got into the records, I was hooked, you know, and then I went back, and obviously it made a lot more sense, you know, to me at that point.
Nice. Well, I think, too, having Netson on stage with us, he wasn't on stage with us at that time, makes a big difference, too. And Jim's great. The three guitars. I don't know. We actually played a show... we were on tour a few months ago, and we travel different ways. Sometimes we'll travel with in a bus if we have a big long tour around the country.
Yeah.
But if we have like this trip was just a West Coast thing, so we just took a couple vans, and one of our vans broke down. So Jim and Brett ended up having to spend the night somewhere. To fix the van, and we just went on without him and played. We played the show as a three-piece.
Oh.
And before we went out on stage, or actually, as I went out on stage to set up my stuff, you know, and people were talking, and I heard someone talking. I'd never heard anyone say this before. Some dude was like, he's like talking to his buddy. He's like, dude, you're gonna love it, man. It's so awesome. It's like fucking wall of guitars. Just like so much stuff going on and on about the three guitar attack of the band, and I kind of just looked up and just kind of shook my head, and someone's like, "Oh, Doug, you're so modest," and I'm like, "No." And, you know, it was fine, but you know, it was really cool to hear that, though, too. It was kind of a bad time to hear it, but it was like, it was nice to, you know that people were appreciate. And I don't think three guitars is a subtle thing, but there's something subtle about it.
I remember specifically seeing you guys at Showbox, and there's a song called, is it Unconventional Wisdom? Is that the name of it?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And the three guitars in that one, that melody line just sings, man. It really sings, and it was just implanted in my head, like, seriously, man, like, just like a earwig just digging itself. It was so intense with three guitars, man.
Nice, thanks.
Yeah. One time I saw you guys do Broken Chairs at the Rock Candy back in the day, and it was amazing, and I think about this all the time. That song's so catchy at the end with the whistling line and all that. You one by one replaced each member in the band, and the song went on for, like, I don't know, 30, 35 minutes, it seemed like to me. It was amazing. Do you remember that show?
I don't, but you say, like, we had substitutes play for us or something?
You had the Delusions come out afterwards and slowly one by one replace you and keep the song going. It was really, really rad.
Nice. I don't remember that one specifically. We do that every once in a while.
Okay. Who were your guitar playing inspirations growing up, man?
Well, as a little kid, I don't think I really knew. You know, I just liked music, but...
Yeah.
I guess when I got to be a teenager, I think, sorry, I had to be quiet for a second while I was in the house.
That's okay, dude.
I think, you know, Jay Mascis, I like Neil Young and because he's, and Jay Mascis too, they're both really, really good guitar players.
Yeah.
But I kind of think the coolest things they do are simple and sort of weird, you know, where it's sort of visceral, someone like Eric Clapton would play everything real smooth. Neil Young just, like, you know, wanking it with his whammy bar and just making it, you know, just weirding it out. So I was attracted to that. And Thurston Moore, you know, he's kind of the epitome of that, where I don't know how technically good that guy is. Probably not at all, but in a way, he's technically amazing because only he can do, you know, the things he does, too. Just visceral. It's about the way this stuff sounds and not thinking about the school of guitar playing.
I feel like Isaac Brock, how you describe Thurston Moore, I might describe him as well.
Mm-hmm.
His guitar playing, anyway.
Absolutely, yeah, he definitely falls into that category. I mean, Isaac doesn't even know the names of chords, I don't think, you know, and he doesn't want to. He wants to keep it that way.
He used to do that bendy thing, man, with his old, like, that old piece of crap blue guitar he would play in the late 90s.
And yeah, he doesn't have a whammy bar. He wouldn't use a whammy bar, he'd just hit it with his palm.
Exactly, and I just was like, who the hell is this guy? I don't know if he can play, but I was completely blown away by it. Absolutely.
Yeah, he kind of made, he had his own little technique there. It was, you know, it made the sound.
And then I later heard a Talking Heads song, and it was this bendy thing, and I'm like, is that where the reference of Talking Heads and Modest Mouse comes in? I don't know if Isaac got any of that from him, but whatever. who...
I'll tell you this much.
Yeah,
whatever, any little one thing that Isaac or anyone has ever done, it's all gotten done.
right.
Whatever bending happened, that's all happened a million times. What Isaac did, though, is bend it with his palm. I don't know that anyone was doing that. Or,
okay,
you know,
I got it, yeah.
He might have made that up in his own way. But, you know, bending notes, that's as old as music, probably.
Right. No doubt. Who's your favorite band of all time? And what I mean by that is, from a young child, you discover them, and to this day, they still are large, you know, they loom largely in your head. Who's that?
I don't know, maybe like David Bowie or something, you know?
Bowie.
Like I said, like him since I was a teenager. Is that what you mean? Just like someone that I always have liked and still love just as much as ever?
Exactly. I would have guessed Neil Young, because when I hear you, I do hear some Neil Young even in your singing. Do you find that that's true or not? Am I just projecting that?
Oh, I think it might be... I definitely think there's a similar quality to our voices. We're both bad singers. I would definitely be singing like David Bowie if I could.
Okay.
David Bowie's way bigger influence for me. I'm way bigger fan of his.
What record
like,
in particular?
I like of David Bowie. Yeah. That's kind of what I like about him is that he has so many different kinds of records.
Yeah.
But you know, I love Ziggy Stardust. I love Changes. I love Let's Dance. I love Scary Monsters, Heroes, Low. Almost everything. I love Diamond Dogs, and they're all just really different kinds of records. But I think overall, Bowie's kind of my main guy. Just overall in music, I think he was the biggest deal to me.
That's very interesting to know, man. Let's see here. I had a question. I've tried to talk with people what indie rock means to them. Now, I feel like you came around and were kind of described as indie rock with a few other bands. And what does the term indie rock actually mean to you, if anything?
Well, I think obviously it means independent music.
Right.
But I think as far as just describing like a sound or a genre, I think it just means people that are music that just sounds independent minded, you know, that it sounds like it's excuse me, I think of it as stuff that's just done for music itself and not specifically made as a commercial commodity,
even if it's even if it's done on a major label, like it's more the sound.
Yeah, exactly. And of course it is a commercial commodity. Everything is in this world. I mean, that's our religion.
Right.
But it's it comes from somewhere else. Its sole concern is not to sell and not to figure out what needs to be done to sell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I think of it. I think of just a spirit of independence.
Right on, man. And what's in the future for Built to Spill? I think you guys are recording a record or just did. Is that right, or am I mistaken on that?
Actually, both are right. We did record a record.
Yeah.
And then the rhythm section guys quit, and that got bagged. And so now we're working on songs, and we will probably get into the studio, probably next summer. We have a real busy time. We have... Basically, in 2 weeks, we begin touring. We tour till the end of the year, almost. And then, next year, January, we'll start working again. And hopefully by spring, maybe, or summertime, we'll be ready to make a record. I think it's going to take us a while to just to get around to doing it. I think we're going to do some of those songs that we already recorded, but reworked a little bit, and then... I just think it's going to take us a while. I think our drummer is going to take a long time figuring out exactly what he wants to do. I think he's just a real analytical kind of person. I think he's going to make sure that he's completely satisfied with what he comes up with. And I can use the time, too, to write more lyrics. And I'd like to rehearse the stuff a ton before we record it so it sounds real. But I'm excited about it, and eventually we'll get around to it.
Now, I know you just did Doe Bay Festival. How was that, man?
That was wonderful. That was beautiful. Have you been there?
I've been there. I haven't been to the festival, but I saw where they actually play in the gorgeous island out there in Orcas. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was everything I hoped it would be.
Did you see any bands that really blew your mind or that you really liked on that particular weekend?
I did, yeah. I saw a few good things. Yeah, it was really fun. I saw Grizzled Mighty. That's real good.
Okay.
La Luz, that was my favorite.
Yeah, they're blowing up, man. They're opening for Of Montreal and just signed to Hardly Art and all that. They're doing good.
Yeah, they're playing here with Of Montreal too. Yeah, those guys are incredible. And actually, was a fan of Sheena's other band, Curious Mysteries. I didn't know she was in that Curious Mystery.
Right, off K-Records.
And she's a comic artist too. Yeah, exactly. She's a comic artist, too, and I haven't seen her comics yet, but after I saw them, I looked her up on the internet, and she's like, she's into Dan Close, my favorite comic book artist, too, so yeah, those guys were really neat. They sounded beautiful out there too. It sounded so cool and just such a nice, beautiful atmosphere in the middle of the afternoon in the wilderness, trees behind them. Fun.
Dude, that's awesome. You know, if you like her artwork,
and also, sorry, one more thing I want to mention about that I met there was this Passenger String Quartet was another thing that I really loved, and I got to play a couple songs with them. They were amazing, and they played with a few different artists, and hopefully I'll get to work with them some more because they're awesome.
In what capacity would you just do some guitar work for them?
No, I think that maybe they might do some stuff for us. Maybe.
Oh, sorry.
Maybe we'll have some strings on our record or something. And also, I talked to them a little bit about there's a festival here in Boise in March called Tree Fort, and maybe having them come down to Tree Fort and play and maybe collaborate with some artists.
Hmm. That's the Passenger String Quartet. Is that what you said?
Yeah, and they're from Seattle. I wish I could remember the leader's name is Andrew. I can't remember his last name. It's so horrible, but he's amazing. He kind of wrote string parts for a few songs of mine that I played solo at that thing, and just did a great job. So he and I are talking about maybe doing some string arrangements for some of the new Built to Spill songs.
Wow!
For Tree Fort, I'd like to have them come and do that with a few artists, you know. You know, who knows, maybe even La Luz. I'd love to hear La Luz with some strings for a few songs.
Oh, what I was going to say, man, is that girl you're talking about, Shayna, she designed a T-shirt for Hollow Earth Radio, which is the radio station that we're broadcasting from right now.
And nice. Cool.
I'd be happy to send you one.
I'd love one.
They're really great. We got three colors, man. We got yellow, blue, and hot pink. What one seems to appeal to you the most?
You know what? Hands down, blue.
Okay. And what are you, medium or large?
Large. Oh, you're so sweet.
Large, blue shirt. And I'll get that address from you at another time. Listen, Doug, I wanted to let you know that this has been a real pleasure. I was a little bit nervous. I was glad to hear that you were a little bit nervous. I have no idea why, but,
I was just kidding. I wasn't really nervous. I was trying to make you feel better.
You were going to make, yeah, that's really sweet. I appreciate that.
I should be nervous though, because, I just did a live interview and it's also being kept forever. So
and I do have your permission to put it on a podcast at a later time.
We'll see about that, Jesse. We'll talk about that later.
Okay, we'll talk about that later, man. I wanted to thank you so much. It's been awesome, and I'm a big fan. I have been for like 15 years now. Can't wait to see you again. And you've always been very kind. You know, I've asked you to get on your guest list. You probably don't remember two or three times just randomly, like at a sound check, and you've always done it. And you're very kind as a performer, and I appreciate that, man.
Hey, I appreciate it so much, Jesse. Thanks for having me. Well, when I saw the thing, I was like, and then I kind of looked at a couple of your set lists and looked like you're playing some cool music. And I can't believe you didn't drop your band name on me. Could have gotten this done even quicker.
Dude, you replied in about 48 hours, man. I mean, I was fine with that.
Hey, thanks, Jesse.
Hey, you're welcome, Doug. Thank you, and I hope to see your band soon, and it's been a real pleasure. Have a great day, man.
Take care.
See you, dude. Bye.
Hey, Jesse.
What's up, man?
Do we hang up now?
Yeah, you can
hang up. Do you want that address?
I want the address, but it's going out live, so I don't want to take that. But you know what you could do while you're on? I want you to say say something for me after I count down from three. If you could go, this is Doug Marsh from whatever band you want to mention that you've been in.
Sure.
And you're listening to The Shit Show with J-Bo. And that's it. Could you do that?
Yep. Hey, this is Doug Marsh from Built to Spill. You're listening to The Shit Show with J-Bo.
Okay. That's awesome. And you know what I'll do? I'll call you after the show, after noon my time, and I'll get that address from you, okay?
I will email it to you.
Okay, do that. Sounds great.
Hey, bye, Jesse.
See you, bro. Bye-bye.